our ability to project ourselves in space. But space without time is like muscle without brain. Time appears to us to move, to flow, to have duration, length, therefore to be spatial. In other words, we are caught in the apparent movement of time. Yet all spiritual paths talk of the primordial importance of living in the present. So what is the present moment? Is it a second or something smaller? Logically, the present can only be an infinitesimally small unit of time. That is to say, a second divided by infinity. There's no such thing. As a length of time, the present simply does not exist. How then can we live in the present? It is a paradoxical impossibility. We have to find the present by other means. The only way to do this is to divorce it from past and future. In that way, time cannot flow. Literally, it stops, as it does in meditation or samadhi. Shavasana is the key to this understanding. All our identities, our affiliations, link us to past and future. Nothing at all in our lives links us to the present except the state of being. Acting takes place over time. It has duration. Being transcends time. A state of being can only be achieved by cutting all the threads which bind to past or future. I was born a man. I will be a man tomorrow. Can I now in Shavasana put down even the sexual identity which links me to past and future? Can I exist in discrete awareness of time in which neither past nor future impinge or taint the present? Shavasana is being without was. Being without will be. It is being without anyone who is. Is it any wonder that it is the most difficult asana and the door to non-dualist meditation and the cosmic fusion of samadhi? When past and future are discarded, what remains must be the present. Suppose you spend 5 minutes in the present in a wonderful shavasana. Is it a 5-minute shavasana? No. It is an infinity of present moments, discrete and juxtaposed, but not joined or continuous. It's like looking at a roll of cinematographic film in which you can see that each photograph shows a picture and then there's a jump, however slight, to the next reality. They do not slide together unless you watch them in movement when they appear continuous. The psychological flow of time ties us to past and future identities and events. As long as we're caught in the flow of time as a sequence of movements, we cannot fully be in the present. Therefore, we live in a sort of compromised reality. That is why I say the time seen as movement and not as presence is an illusion which limits our freedom. Shavasana frees us from this. I said that in meditation, we open the gap in the curtain of time. It is in Shavasana, by becoming nobody, literally nothing and nobody, that we become small enough to pass through the infinitesimally small crack in the curtain. A practitioner who can put aside his every identity can access places where no plump ego could squeeze through. If skeptics seek an analogy for the seeming continuity or seamlessness of what appears to us as a flow of change, you should look at the phenomenon of water heating. It does not get a little bit hotter gradually as it seems to us. Like the individual slides in our film, it jumps. Very small jumps, of course. But water being heated is first one temperature, and then it jumps to another, slightly hotter. There's no in-between. What this suggests is that life is a series of discrete transformations, where in one state, we practice, we detach, then we're in another. What we experience as growth or evolution is in fact a long series of little jumps. These jumps are instantaneous, which means they exist outside time as we conceive it. The ultimate yogic triumph is to live in Kaivalya, outside time, you might say, but really inside it, inside its heart, disconnected from past and from future. That is to live always in the kernel of the present. It is the integration of the true nature of time in consciousness, and Shavasana is the key. By all means, relax, go to sleep even. We are all human. But in Shavasana, you are on the edge of a great mystery. And if Shavasana is the most difficult of all postures, at least it has the saving grace that we can all lie on the floor as we attempt it. All models for spiritual life or personal growth seduce us into the belief that we are becoming rather than just being. Being is not static, but like the heating water we just mentioned, it is a moment in present time in a certain state or condition, and from which, if we continue to add the flame of zealous practice like a Bunsen burner under a retort, suddenly another state will spontaneously emerge as if by magical transformation. We perceive only the sequence of these transformations in time, which is why we are caught in the illusion of becoming instead of just being, and then being again and being again, separately but transformatively, ad infinitum, like the stills of an old silent film, until the story reaches its conclusion and hopefully its happy ending. This idea of a ladder to be climbed, even if it is in some ways flawed, and certainly leads to invidious comparisons between practitioners or the establishment of a hierarchy of excellence, is pretty universal. Yoga avoids this because all petals are practiced simultaneously and form a composite whole. I believe in the perfection of the yogic system as a vehicle to enlightenment. I also support the Indian cricket team. Life puts us in one place at a time, and we must live to the best of our abilities from that point. But when people evoke to me the perennial wisdom of the mysterious Orient, as if all other men throughout history had been misguided and unevolved, I become impatient. The mind of man is one. The mechanics of consciousness are the same everywhere. A good person, living ethically, with his eyes on the stars and his or her feet set on the path of duty, is a good person anywhere. A problem is a problem anywhere. To the extent that yoga offers both understanding and a blueprint for action, it offers them everywhere to be all people at all times. Yoga cannot be preached about or proselytized. It can only be adopted, and its success in being adopted around the world is proof not of cunning salesmanship, but of practical efficacy and high aspirations, which are the province of all humankind. Life is learning. This whole book has been founded on a series of demarcations, the five sheaths, the five elements, their five subtle counterparts. It is a fruitful way to direct the quest towards the exploration of nature and the discovery of the soul. But in the back of our minds, we should not forget that all sheaths and elements, all obvious demarcations, whether between gross or subtle bodies, do not arise at all. All are interwoven in consciousness. Hence, the ultimate reach of yoga is the total transformation of citta, consciousness, which pervades our whole being with awareness and which knows no frontiers. My hope is to have overcome the prejudice that hatha yoga is only physical and that it has nothing to do with spiritual life. People have equated the practice of asana with physical practice. My life's work has been to show how, even from humble beginnings, this is a path which can lead the dedicated practitioner to the integration of body, mind, and soul. What I have endeavored to say about asana is that the posture should be comfortable and steady. The steadiness comes only when the effort has ended, so you have to train the body in such a way that what seems complex becomes simple. We are wrong to think that we are all dull and inert. If your fire were extinguished, you would not be alive. Yoga fire exists in a latent or pristine state in everyone. It has consumed my life. But nothing is accomplished forever. If I let cool ashes cover my fire through carelessness, arrogance, or laxity of practice, the fire will lose its transforming heat. I have not retired and never shall. I will always keep the inner fire burning. That is why practice, sadhana, cannot be stopped. Of course I age and regress at certain levels, but my body and mind are the servers and followers of the soul. The unity of these three gives me the right to call myself a yogi. But even though I'm on a spiritual level, I will never say that practice is not required. I am old and death inevitably approaches, but both birth and death are beyond the will of a human being. They are not my domain. I do not think about it. Yoga has taught me to think of only working to live a useful life. The complexity of the life of the mind comes to an end at death, with all its sadness and happiness. If one is already free from that complexity, then death comes naturally and smoothly. If you live holistically at every moment, as yoga teaches, even though the ego is annihilated, I will not say, die before you die. I would rather say, live before you die, so that death is also a lively celebration. Hokusai, the great Japanese artist, said, when he was already in his 70s, that given another 10 years, he would be a great artist. I salute his humility. Let me conclude by quoting the words of the Spanish artist Goya, who, in the 78th year of his life, when he was already deaf and debilitated, said, Aún aprendo. I am still learning. It's true for me, too. I will never stop learning, and I've tried to share some of these lessons with you. I do pray that my ending will be your beginning. The great rewards and the countless blessings of a life spent following the inward journey await you.
We hope you've enjoyed Light on Life, the yoga journey to wholeness, inner peace, and ultimate freedom, an audio renaissance audiobook from Rodale Books. This program was produced by Lisa Bainey. Text copyright 2005 by BKS Iyengar. Production copyright 2005 by Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtzbrinck Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.